Essa mulher assim mesmo. Essa mulher assim mesmo. Eu quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Eu quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Eu quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Essa mulher assim mesmo. Eu quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Eu quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Para de nada. Quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Alucinada. Quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Despenteada. Quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Descabelada. Quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Embriagada. Quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Intoxicada. Quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Desafinada. Quero essa mulher assim mesmo. Desentuada. Quero essa mulher assim mesmo.
Yeah. Music there from Jenny Hval, Give Me That Sound from Innocence is Kinky, preceded by Caetano Veloso, De Cara from Arasa Azul. Oh boy, I wanted to play that one last week after listening to Dave Mandel and Erwin Chusid and Evan Funk Davies talk about their favorite drum songs. That's mine! Couldn't find it in the library, though, because it turns out Dwayne pulled it out of the wall and stuck it in the old bin because he knows what a wonderful record it is. Man, he put three of my favorite records in the old bin this week, including something else. We heard that set from Gandalf. Get there in a minute. Giorgio Moroder, Call It Go, from Schlager Moroder Volume 1, 1966 to 1975. Pan American, The Cloud Room, from The Cloud Room, Glass Room, pseudo-coded Back to the Waters from 40 Days, 40 Nights, Volume 1 compilation. Gandalf, from the self-titled record in 1968. Golden Earrings, Tom Rashawn, from Tony Coulter's great 2013 WFMB Marathon Premium called Out Demons Out. Piano, DJ Peanuts before that with Rolling Stoner from Put the Fun in Funeral 7-inch, Dwight Sykes, Wherever You Are from Songs Volume 1, we heard Dump, new one from Dump on Grapefruit, it's called The Silent Treatment, we heard I Don't Mind, Fumio Miyashita, Ellipse from Journey to Space, thank you Nat Rowe, shoving that one into the old bin. Ilaiyaraaja before that. New one's called Electro Euphoric Electronics and Robotic Funk by Maestro Ilaiyaraaja. Thulam Ilamai, track we heard. Amandul 2 with Eye Shaking King from Yeti. And new one from Richard Pinas. It's called Desolation Row. From it we heard South. That, my friends, is everything we heard. I won't see you next week. Of course, David Sussman will be filling in for me as I am heading off to Spain for the Primavera Sound Festival. Talk to you Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from there. That's it. Thank you for listening. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope Worldwide, WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is next.
So my guest just canceled about 2.5 hours ago, so I didn't know what I was going to do. Pulled up a couple old files, was trying to mix them together for something at least, you know, semi-alive and kicking. And then, just about a half hour ago, I saw on the Twitter that Ray Manzarek had just died. And Ken Friedman said, why don't you pull out Myth and Reality, the spoken word history of the Doors from the library? And I did. And dear listener, we will be hearing excerpts from this 2-CD collection in honor of Ray Manzarek's passing for the rest of the hour here on Too Much Information. So stay tuned for that.
On July 3rd, 1971, Jim Morrison died in Paris under what can only be called mysterious circumstances. We don't know what happened to Jim in Paris, and I don't think we're ever going to know what happened to Jim in Paris. And the last time I saw Jim was in the recording studio when we were finishing up the album L.A. Woman. And that's actually the last time Jim Morrison was in a recording studio, the last time he ever sang, to my knowledge, on planet Earth. Certainly the last time he ever sang with the Doors. But the last recording session, the last time Jim Morrison ever sang with the Doors, was that haunted little whisper voice of Riders on the Storm on the L.A. Woman album. And after he did that, he said, I'm going to Paris. I said, whoa, what a good idea, man. I thought it was an excellent idea. He said, we're close to being finished here. We've got most of the mixes done. We only got a couple more songs to mix. Everything sounds great. Why don't you guys just go ahead and finish up? And that was kind of unusual, too, because Jim would always be around. He wouldn't leave. I mean, you know, he wouldn't be there for all the mixing, but he'd certainly come in to listen to the final mixes, the final takes and the final mix and to hear the final album. So for Jim to actually leave before he heard the entire finished album was very unusual, and I should have realized something was up at that time. But he said, go ahead and finish it up. You know, you get 2 or 3 songs. Everything sounds great, man. I'm leaving tomorrow for Paris. Pam's already over there. She's got a little apartment and got it all set up. She left a couple of weeks before me, and I'm going to join her over there in Paris. We said, well, that's interesting. Paris, huh? How long are you going to be over there? He said, you know, I don't know. Couple of months, 6 months, I don't know, maybe even a year, who knows, man, I don't know. And I said, you know, that's a good idea, dude, because we had finished our Elektra contract. We had delivered the requisite amount of recordings to Elektra Records. Our contract was concluded, and we were now a free and clear band to re-sign with Elektra if we wanted, to sign with another record company, to do whatever we wanted, or do nothing, you know, to take a long break and just think about man, God, existence, and life. And we had a little bit of money in the bank from the record sales, so we were free to do anything we wanted. So Jim was going to go to Paris. And I said, that's a great idea, actually. Get away from your drinking buddies. please get away from the bad companions and the hangers-on that were always glomming on to Jim and taking him to the bar, and Jim was always paying, and he would wine and dine these sort of ne'er-do-well friends of his, quote-unquote friends, and they were just sucking up his energy and sucking his vital essence and keeping him away from being a poet. He would sit in the bar and talk all his energy away, you know? He wouldn't be home writing. I mean, what he should have been doing was writing instead of talking it out and staggering in way past the midnight hour, far too late. And Pam was always mad at him because he was always running around and getting drunk with his friends. And so Pam and Jim had a stormy relationship. And I think to make things up with her, he was going to go to Paris with her. Why they had picked Paris, I have no idea. They should have gone to London. It would have been a lot better. But they went to Paris for some reason or another. But I thought, that's great. Paris is great because that's the city of light, the city of artists, an American in Paris, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Henry Miller. And man, that's just get away from all of this L.A. stuff and this whole rock and roll thing and become a poet again. Become the guy that I knew back in Venice, the guy that I knew in film school at UCLA, the writer, the artist, the good guy, the good human being, the funny human being, the intelligent, sensitive, energized young man that I knew back in Venice. And I thought, this is going to be great. Go to Paris and do it, man. Start to write again. Start to become an artist. Just be an artist again. Don't be a rock star. Be an artist. And off he went. And he said, I'll see you, brother. And I said, okay, man, you know, just stay in touch and we'll talk to you in a while. He went off to Paris and, you know, we didn't hear anything from Jim one way or the other for about a month and a half, 2 months. Record had come out. L.A. Woman was doing great. People say, the Doors are back. The critics said, the Doors are back with their intensity and power once again. And critics loved it. And sales were doing very nicely. And Lover Madly was a hit single. So you had a hit single on an album that had some great long songs, Riders on the Storm and L.A. Woman and like that. And Jim called John Densmore and asked John how the record's doing. And John said, oh, man, it's doing great. You know, it's racing up the charts and people love it. And Jim said, oh, it's terrific, man. He said, man, as soon as I get back, we got to go on the road. I want to play those songs live. You know, I mean, we never got to play those songs live. John said to him, exactly, man. Boy, I'd love to play L.A. Woman and Riders on the Storm. We could take a bass player with us. And Jim said, yeah, why don't we take that guy that played with us, that Jerry Sheff guy, man. We'll take him on the road with us. And John said, yeah, that's a great idea. We'll take him. Maybe we'll take the guitar player. Maybe not. Maybe we'll get some other guitar player. At least take the bass player along. And Morrison said, boy, I can't wait to play those songs. As soon as I get back, man, let's book a little tour. What do you say? And John said, okay, man, when are you coming back? And Jim said, I don't know. You know, I'm having a pretty good time. And, you know, I'll be here for a while yet. And John said, okay, man, well, you know, next time I talk to you, you know, stay cool, man. Enjoy yourself. And that was like in the middle, early June. That was early June. And then by July 3rd, that was it, man. I got a phone call telling me that Jim Morrison is dead. A phone call from this guy that was our manager. And he called and said, I just got a phone call from Paris saying that Jim Morrison is dead. And I said, get out of here. I don't believe it, man, Jim Morrison. Jim Morrison said, Paul is dead. There was a lot of, everybody's dead at that time. Paul is dead because he was walking across the street on the Beatles album, Abbey Road, and he was walking out of step and he didn't have shoes on. And in Italy, if you don't have shoes on, that means you're a corpse. You had a suit but no shoes. That's how they bury a corpse. And see, he's out of step with the other three guys, that means he's dead. You know, people were starting to get a little death-obsessed. Manson had happened, and, you know, the whole thing was getting a little weird. You know, obviously the Kennedys were dead, and Martin Luther King was dead, so people were starting to think, my God, Vietnam, the ghosts, you know, this planet was filled with ghosts of dead young soldiers and Vietnamese women and children and Vietnamese soldiers. They were hovering on the planet. So it was starting to get a little spooky on planet Earth. So, you know, I said, I don't believe it, man. It's just death rumors, you know, because Jim, here's a funny story. Jim, we were at a party, you know, and Jim was supposed to be at the party, didn't come, was a little late coming to the party. Somebody runs in and says, Jim Morrison's just been killed in an automobile accident. Went, oh, my God. 5 minutes later, Jim walks in the door. We said, Jim, man, I thought you were dead. He said, no, rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. You know, always quoting somebody, a Mark Twain quote. And I said, you know. And then it was another time he had fallen out of a window and he was supposed to be dead. So when I heard the story that Jim Morrison was dead, I said, oh, that's ridiculous, man. It's just more of that paranoid death stuff. And this guy said, no, this time I think it's serious. And I said, well, you know, I'm certainly not going to Paris to check out some silly rumor, you know. And he said, don't worry, I've got a 12 o'clock flight. This is like 8 o'clock in the morning. So I got the 12 o'clock flight to Paris. I'm going over there. And okay, fine. Well, find out this time, will you, man? I mean, just, and I said to him, I said, make sure. Just make sure this time, will you? 3-4 days later, I get a phone call. This guy says to me, we just buried Jim Morrison. This is like on a Friday or Saturday. It was Friday, I think. Maybe it was Saturday. I forget. Friday or Saturday. Monday. It was either Monday or Tuesday morning. We just buried Jim Morrison. I said, what? I said, what are you talking about? I said, yeah. I said, wait a minute. This is like a rumor. This is not a rumor. This is not a silly little paranoid fantasy. You mean he's dead? Yeah, he's dead. We put the coffin in the ground. Cemetery is called Père Lachaise Cemetery. It's right in Paris. Beautiful old cemetery. Edith Piaf is there, and Isadora Duncan is there, and Heloise and Abelard, and, you know, Céline may be buried there for all I know. Chopin is there, and Molière is there. So there's a lot of artists there. Beautiful old. I said, I don't care who's there, man. I don't. Wait a minute. What happened? This guy's, I don't know. I don't know what happened. Was he hit by a truck or something? No, his heart stopped. His heart stopped? What are you talking about? I said, how does he look? How does he look? And this guy said, I don't know. I never saw the body. I said, hold it. What do you mean you didn't see the body? It was a sealed coffin. They buried a sealed coffin. And I said, you mean let me see Jim Morrison. I want to see Jim Morrison dead. You're telling me Jim Morrison is dead. Show me Jim Morrison dead. As a manager of the band, you say, that's our lead singer, that's Jim Morrison. Let me see Jim Morrison dead. Jim Morrison was never seen dead. That coffin was put in the ground, covered over, and that was it. I said, that's it? He said, that's all I know, man. I'm telling you what I know. I was here. He's dead. Pam was all broken up. I'm telling you, Pam was just crying and weeping and everything. And, you know, I just couldn't bring myself to open the coffin. I said, oh, God. And we're waiting for Jim to come back. You know, we're working on some songs. John and Robbie and I are getting together, you know, every Tuesday and Thursday, a couple of hours in the afternoon, putting some little ditties together, working on some tunes, a little of this, a little of that, keeping the chops up, writing some songs. I had started writing some stuff. John was working on some songs himself, and we're taking this opportunity to do some woodshedding, as they call it, and work on some tunes and waiting for Jim to come back. And all of a sudden, assuming, of course, that Jim's coming back, all of a sudden, Jim Morrison is not only is he not coming back, Jim Morrison is dead. Jim Morrison will never be seen again. Your buddy, your pal, your friend, your brother, your soulmate, the guy, you know, Dionysus. I played Apollo to his Dionysus, and Apollo and Dionysus are never going to hug again, are never going to make love again on stage, are never going to make art together. So everybody in the band was completely destroyed, man. And that's the story. So I first met Jim Morrison. Jim Morrison and I actually went to the film school at UCLA. That's where the Doors got started. Doors got started at the UCLA Film School, University of California, Los Angeles. And the time period was 1963, 1964, when we were film students at UCLA. We graduated in the summer of 1965. I got my master's degree, and Jim got a bachelor's degree, unlike what is portrayed in the heinous film about the Doors. Jim Morrison did not quit UCLA. He did not say, I quit, after they panned his film. And they did pan his film. I mean, Jim's film was not highly received by the collective student body and the faculty at UCLA at the time of the student screenings. But personally, I thought it was brilliant. So Jim's film was basically it was poetry. What's interesting about it, it was a cinematic poetry. It was a juxtaposition of images that really didn't have any relationship to each other necessarily. But after 7 to 8 minutes went by, it became a collective whole and became a poetic piece. And I thought it was quite brilliant. It was nonlinear. It was purely experimental. It had a great shot of Jim doing a great hit toke off of a huge bomber, which for those of you know what a bomber is, a spliff, a doob, a blunt. Because we were all heads at the time. See, that's the whole point of it, the whole point of the UCLA Film School and the whole point of 1963, 64, 65, 67 in Venice is that we were all heads. Everyone was high. Everyone was giggling and laughing and having just the grandest time. You know, that's what that intoxicant does to you, that the good green herb that grows on God's good green planet is an intoxicant. It's a delightful thing that just takes you into another state of being that puts you into a very silly, funny state. So Jim Morrison's student movie was a very silly, very funny, and very poetic student movie along the lines of Jonas Mekas' film culture out of New York City. Now, I myself had made a couple of student movies at UCLA also, starring my girlfriend at the time, Dorothy Fujikawa, who has long since become my wife. And we're still happily married and still together, and it's been a wonderful relationship. But she was the star of my student movies, and they had what was called the Royce Hall screenings at UCLA, and they would select, 12 to 14 student movies out of the year to show at Royce Hall, the prestigious hall where symphonies were performed, and Odetta would sing, the Modern Jazz Quartet would play, the Los Angeles Symphony Orchestra performed there. I walked in on a rehearsal once of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and it was absolutely overwhelming. Standing right at the foot of the stage, Zubin Mehta was the conductor, and I'm watching the LA Philharmonic do the Rite of Spring in Royce Hall. Well, lo and behold, a few months later, Ray Manzarek's student film Induction, and the year before that, Evergreen, were shown at the Royce Hall screenings, and that was like a big honor for the best dozen or so student movies. Jim's didn't make it in, unfortunately. He was panned by the students and panned by the teachers, so his movie didn't make it into the screening, nor did it actually make it through the projector. He had trouble with making splices. Jim's forte was not splicing two pieces of film together with a tiny little tape and the tiny little 16-millimeter splicer that you had to use. My two movies, however, Induction and Evergreen, made it into the Royce Hall screening, so they exist. And in my student movies, you can see what UCLA looked like in 1962-3-4, the early days, the actual Venice apartment that we lived in. And Induction is about my going into the Army after a tumultuous love affair that ended badly, and my joining the Army. And you can see that movie, Induction and Evergreen, are on the Doors Laserdisc, called The Doors Collection on, here's the plug, folks, on MCA Universal Home Video. So at UCLA, the actual schooling at UCLA, the film school, was absolutely fabulous. We had some incredibly great professors who, at the time, were trying to get us to be like the French Nouvelle Vague, like Kurosawa in Japan, and Ozu, and Mizoguchi, the Japanese directors, or Satyajit Ray, or Fellini, and Ermanno Olmi, and directors like that. And that's what they wanted us to be. They wanted us to be artists. They were pushing us in the direction of artists. And Colin Young was the head of the department. He brought in visiting Hollywood heavyweights and worldwide heavyweights to come and teach at UCLA. One of the teachers at UCLA was none other than the fabled French director Jean Renoir, the son of Renoir the painter and the great director Jean Renoir himself. And he brought romance to the school, that great French romanticism. And I never had a class with him. I was about to take, he taught the directing class. I was about to take the directing class, and he had gone. You know, the summer had gone by, and he was only there for 1 year. I had signed up for the directing class in the fall, so they brought in a substitute for Jean Renoir. Changed my whole life, man. Joseph von Sternberg. I actually was taught a directing class by Joseph von Sternberg, who directed all the Marlene Dietrich movies, who directed her in The Blue Angel and The Shanghai Express and Morocco and The Devil is a Woman and Blonde Venus and Scarlet Empress. And von Sternberg was changed my life. He changed my outlook on art. He was the one who was able to take that that dark, brooding, Germanic romanticism, film noir, and expressionism, and just he opened my mind to how to make movies that were deeply passionate and perhaps even slightly kinky, who knows. I think the Doors music eventually came out to be slightly kinky and slightly Germanic. I mean, the Doors did the Whiskey Bar, Brecht and Weill. So, and Jim Morrison, the next semester after me, took the same class with Joseph von Sternberg. So here's these two guys who are going to put together the Doors come 2-3 years later, and they are both being affected by Joseph von Sternberg, the director of Marlene Dietrich. And maybe that's why the Doors are what they are today. So Joseph von Sternberg took us into the small 3K7, bungalow 3K7, the screening room, where all the films were shown and all the student films were shown. And he sat us down and said, okay, boys and girls, students, I'm going to show you The Blue Angel. I'm going to show you Morocco. I'm going to show you The Shanghai Express, which was my absolute all-time favorite. Marlene Dietrich and Anna May Wong together in The Shanghai Express were two of the sexiest women I have ever seen in my life. And I thought, I want to be married to both of these women. This is what I want. I want this. I want the blonde Venus, and I want the dragon lady. The two of them were absolutely gorgeous, absolutely sensual, stunning, and just brilliant, brilliant women. And if I may say so, you know, I think Dorothy Fujikawa comes as close to putting those two women together as any woman I've ever met. And perhaps that's why we're still married, and that's why she was the star of my student movies. So von Sternberg took us into the bungalow 3K7, but also Colin Young and the other guys at UCLA, Ed Brokaw and Bill Adams and Hugh Gray, another learned, scholarly gentleman, brought in filmmakers from Hollywood and avant-garde filmmakers. We saw at UCLA, we saw Kenneth Anger's film, Scorpio Rising. We saw, and this is funny, we saw the Andy Warhol movies. The first movie we saw was called Sleep. And here's a guy sleeping. And so we stood there, we watched the movie for 5 minutes and said, is this it? And somebody said, it goes on for 6 hours. And we said, 6 hours? What did he do, just film the guy sleeping? And he said, yeah, that's the joke, man. Out we went. We came back, and there was another movie playing. We thought, okay, this is going to be good. This is called Empire. We thought, oh, Empire is going to be great because it's going to be about the Empire State or Manhattan and all the kinky stuff going on in Manhattan. It's a shot out the window of the Empire State Building, and it goes, and it goes, and it goes, and that's all it is. And everyone went, boo, Andy, you big phony, get out of here. But boy, I'll tell you, Andy Warhol could tweak the nose of the establishment, and he was certainly tweaking the nose of fine filmmaking. And we saw, this is great, we saw the Maisels Brothers film about the Beatles, the very first tour of the Beatles in America. This is the one with Murray the K as the fifth Beatle, and I forget what that documentary is called, but it's an absolutely brilliant handheld 16mm, a guy with an eclair and another guy with a nagra, and the two of them were just kind of linked together by the cord, and they just went everywhere as this team, and you were there with the Beatles. Interestingly, that movie became Hard Day's Night. So when you see A Hard Day's Night, that is a theatrical recreation of the Maisels Brothers movie that was first shown to us at UCLA. And I swear, man, seeing that movie, Jim Morrison and I looked at that, kind of looked at each other and thought, hey, rock and roll, man. Rock and roll, screaming, people are screaming, and, you know, and then Jim is single, you know, he doesn't have a girlfriend or anything, and chicks, man, all the chicks, look at that, the money, fame, power, music, we can make music and have girls screaming for us. So here I am sitting on the beach in Venice. I've got a bachelor's degree from DePaul University in Chicago in economics. I've got a master's degree from UCLA in cinematography. And I don't know what I'm going to do with myself, or I don't know how I'm going to make a nickel to support us. You know, hopefully I'd be able to make enough money to ask Dorothy to marry me, but I didn't have a nickel to my name nor any job prospects or anything. And I'm sitting in the sun, just being a bum, smoking a joint, some of that good Thai weed that I had left over from Thailand. It was just good stuff. And who comes walking down the beach but James Douglas Morrison? The sun is setting into the Pacific Ocean. Sun is kind of streaming in behind him. The water is glistening. And I see this figure, man, walking along in the shallows, in the shore break, kind of kicking up the water. And as he's kicking up the water, he's making diamonds because of the way the light is hitting the water from behind, the sun coming in low and hard. And these diamonds are coming out of his feet. And I see this guy wearing cutoffs and without a shirt, weighing about, you know, maybe 135 pounds, thin, 6 foot tall, thin rail guy with long hair. And I look and I thought, my God, that is Morrison. So I waved to him. I said, hey, Morrison, Morrison. And he looks over and he sees me and he waves. He says, hey, Ray. Comes walking over to me. I'm 15, 20 feet onto the sand off from the shore break. And here's Jim Morrison. And I said, Jim, what are you doing here, man? I thought you were going to New York City. And he said, nah, you know, I decided to stay here. I said, well, cool, man. What have you been up to? He said, well, I'm living up on Dennis Jacobs' rooftop, a buddy of ours, living on his rooftop. I thought, well, never mind about that. What are you doing? He said, nothing, man. What are you doing? I said, I'm not doing anything. I'm trying to figure out what to do. I said, and he said to me, you been working on anything? I said, well, I've been thinking about some film scripts and whatnot. And I said, how about you? You working on anything? And he said, yeah, I've been writing some songs. And I said, whoa, writing some songs, huh? Because I knew he was a poet. He knew I was a musician. And I said, you know what? Sing me a song, man. Let me hear what you've been writing. Because we were both fully into the grips of, you know, LSD, marijuana. We were into, you know, we'd smoked a little grass and took a little acid. Our consciousness was expanded, and we were in the cosmic zone. And I thought, hey, working on some songs, huh? Sing a song for me. So Jim said, oh, man, I don't have much of a voice. I said, come on, man. Of course you got a voice. You know, Bob Dylan doesn't have much of a voice. You can do fine. Just go ahead and sing. You know, it's just you and me here. I'm not going to judge your singing voice. I just want to hear your words and, you know, what you got in your head. So he squats down in the sand, and he digs his hands into the sand. He gets two handfuls of sand, and he kind of squeezes really tight, and it starts streaming out from his fingers. And I see these rivulets of sand, this waterfall of sand coming out. And he said, okay, here's one I got called Moonlight Drive. And he starts to sing. And I heard these words, man. It was like, let's swim to the moon. Let's climb through the tide. Penetrate the evening that the city sleeps to hide. And I thought, whoa, those are just too cool. That is like, that's psychedelic. I've never heard lyrics like that for rock and roll. So as he's singing it, I'm hearing the chord changes behind it and hearing the things that I could do musically. And it's kind of got a funk groove to it. And it's kind of like, let's swim to the moon. Let's climb through the tide. And I'm playing. And And Jim is singing in this Chet Baker voice. He had this haunted voice. I thought he had one of the best quality voices I'd ever heard. If any of you know who Chet Baker is, he's a trumpet player, and he has this kind of whispery, kind of soft, haunted voice. And here's Morrison on the beach singing Moonlight Drive to me in a decidedly Chet Baker voice, right on pitch, right on tone, and right in the rhythm. He had this nice sense of rhythm, and it just kind of went ka-chunka, chunka, chunka, chunka. And it was hypnotic, man, I was feeling what he was doing. I thought, this is too cool. And he sang the rest of the song, and I said, ah, man, I love it. This is incredible. I said, do you have anything else? And he said, yeah, I've got a couple of other things. One's called Summer's Almost Gone. I got another one called My Eyes Have Seen You. And I said, My Eyes Have Seen You. Oh, this is amazing. And then he sang My Eyes Have Seen You. He did a little of Summer's Almost Gone. And I thought, I don't believe this, man. These are the best songs. I told him, I said, Jim, these are the best songs I've ever heard for rock and roll. With those lyrics, what I can do on the keyboards playing behind that, man, we got to get a rock and roll band together. And he looked at me and he said, Ray, that's exactly what I had in mind. And I said, cool, man. All right. What do we call the band, though? I said, you know, whoops, wait a minute. Okay, let's get realistic here. We got a rock and roll band. He's a great singer. I'm a great keyboard player. And he looks great. And I thought to myself, and I didn't say this to him, I thought, the girls are going to absolutely fall in love with this guy. The lyrics are great. The music is going to be great. We are going to be spooky, weird, and psychedelic. And on top of it, we got probably the best-looking guy I have seen in a long time, since Steve McQueen. You know, it was like a running battle. Who was the best-looking guy? Was it James Dean? James Dean was gone. Okay, you got Steve McQueen and Jim Morrison. My bet would go with Jim Morrison. I thought he looked better than Steve McQueen. It was so I said to him, okay, this is great. What do we call the band? And he said, The Doors. I said, the what? The Doors? That's the most ridiculous. Oh, wait a minute. And I said, wait a minute. You mean like the Doors of Perception? Well, Jim and I met at the UCLA Film School. Obviously, we were both film students, and we got together through a good friend named John DiBella. John DiBella was my cameraman on Evergreen and was Jim's cameraman on the Jim Morrison student movie that had no title and has long since disappeared. So John introduced me to Jim, and John was a poet. Jim was a poet. I was the jazzer, musician, blues guy, not being a poet myself. Jim was obviously, Jim lived by himself. He had an apartment, my goodness gracious. So there were very few people that had as nice an apartment as Jim. Not that it was elaborate or anything, but obviously his mother and father had a couple of books, because as Dorothy said, look, he has an electric blanket. He must have money. Look at his socks, she said. I said, look at his socks. You know, she said, these are expensive socks, Ray. Okay, honey, if you say so. He's got to have money. And Jim had an interesting apartment. One wall was filled with books, and the other wall was a continuing collage just running along the wall, this huge, long collage, this stripe running along for about, it was 9 to 10 feet long, and you would look at it and kind of, it was like a Japanese scroll is what it was. And it was a picture story. It was a picture scroll, and it was like, I never did figure out what story it was telling. I don't think it was telling any story. It was like what Jim was doing poetically. It was a collision of images, Eisensteinian collision of images, a juxtaposition. And, you know, he would have, I remember one thing, he had some gorgeous model next to a shot of four Marines lounging about in a state of déshabille. Anyway, these Marines were lounging about without shirts on and in a very relaxed sort of very sensuous. Genet would have loved it. It was Jean Genet, the author, would have absolutely loved it. And it was a state of ease. And they're juxtaposed up against this this beautiful model, and coming out from them is a snake. And the snake moves into an elephant, and then there's an African scene, and it just kind of just kept on going and going. So Jim was the first guy I ever knew to actually have a collage on his wall next to his huge wall of books. And, you know, the story goes of Jim Morrison that he was able to tell you the title and the author of any book he had. He would challenge people, take a book. I'm going to turn my back. Take a book off the shelf. Open it to any page. Read me a line or two or three. You know, maybe I'll need more. Maybe a paragraph. I'll tell you the title of the book and the author of the book. And the guy was on the money 95% of the time, man. Jim would have Jim's reading was very eclectic, but it was typical of your early to mid 60s hipster student. See, don't forget what we wanted to be. We wanted to be beatniks. We all wanted to be beatniks, but we were too young. We came a little bit too late to enter into true beatnikery. And but we were worshippers of the Beat Generation. So everything that Kerouac wrote, everything that Allen Ginsberg wrote, Michael McClure's writings, Gregory Corso, John Cleland Holmes, all of that stuff, all of the Beat writers filled Morrison's shelf, along with James Joyce, along with Celine. So all the antecedents to the Beat Generation were the same books that we were all reading. So Celine's Journey to the End of the Night, you know, Journey. So one of our songs is called The End of the Night, you know, Take the Highway to the End of the Night. So, I mean, Jim was borrowing, as I was borrowing quotes from all my favorite jazz musicians and blues musicians, Jim was borrowing quotes from all of his favorite writers. So, you know, I mean, even the name The Doors from the line by William Blake, if the doors of perception were cleansed, man would see things as they truly are, infinite. And then Aldous Huxley takes that line, if the doors of perception, calls his book The Doors of Perception. And then Jim said, let's call the band The Doors. So we were always borrowing from past artists. So that Morrison's shelf, a shelf of books, was very eclectic, but standard evergreen review, New York City, hipster, San Francisco hipster, beat, jivester, jivenick. And we all had the same books, you know. John DiBella had the same books as Jim had, as I had, as Dennis Jacobs had, and a bunch of the other guys had. You know? So to this day, one of the things that I have in my collection is I actually have one of Jim's books. I have Jim's dictionary. It doesn't have his name in it, but it has a UCLA student stamp from 1963. And I said to the people at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they said, do you have Jim Morrison's leather pants? I said, why would I have Jim Morrison's leather pants? I don't have Jim's leather pants. Jim has his leather pants. Why would I have his pants? Do you think Jim Morrison has a pair of my shoes? You know, no, I don't have Jim's clothes. What are you talking about? It's absurd. I said, but I do have Jim Morrison's dictionary. Now, what could be more valuable to a poet than his dictionary? They said, we don't know what you want. I have his dictionary. Don't you understand? Jim's a poet. That's why the doors were put together. Poetry and rock and roll. Like the Beatniks do poetry and jazz. We're doing poetry and rock and roll with a jazz influence. Eclectic rock and roll. Spanish flamenco. Jazz. Classical. All of it. Blues brought into this music with Jim as a poet. He's a poet. Here's his dictionary. They said, is it signed? I said, he didn't sign his dictionary. Why would anyone sign their dictionary? It's a dictionary. Don't you know what the karma that goes with this? The chi, the energy, the psychic energy that exists in this book, man. This is his. And I said, we don't want it. I said, okay, very good. So I still have it at home and still use it to this day. And it's the family dictionary. And, you know, we're taking good care of it. And who knows, someday somebody will realize that Jim Morrison's dictionary is more valuable than his dick. I mean, than his leather pants.
Not sure if that day ever came yet, but you are listening to Too Much Information on WFMU. And in honor of Ray Manzarek's leaving the building, we are playing excerpts from his Myth and Reality Spoken Word History of the Doors for the hour today. We got about room for about three or four more tracks, so let's keep this going. All right, looks like this CD2 is not going to work. Let's try this out.
I had done two solid semesters of film school, and my relationship with this girl just fell apart. She wanted to get married. I don't know why she wanted to get married. I didn't want to get married. And then she broke up with me. I thought, you can't break up with me. But. So she left me and went off with some other guy. And I was heartbroken. So I thought, God, man, I'm heartbroken. So I thought, you know what? And I have to be a soldier or something. I thought, well, you know, since I'm heartbroken and completely distraught, this might be a good opportunity to leave this situation, do my military obligation, and get into something, get into cinema. I mean, they have cameramen and stuff, and something in photography or something like that. So that was the next stupid decision I made. Law school and joining the Army were two of the dumbest things I've ever done. I joined the Army and be a cinematographer, be a cameraman. Thank God I didn't, because it was just before Vietnam broke out, and Vietnam could have, the Vietnam War. I could have been a cameraman out in the jungle in Vietnam. That's what would have happened to me. Then, my God, what have I done? That would have been hysterical, you know, out there with a little 16-millimeter Bell and Howell trying to block bullets in the middle of the jungle, man. So I became a darkroom man. I got into darkroom, which that was great. They sent me to Fort Monmouth in New Jersey after I did my basic training at Fort Ord, and went to Fort Monmouth in New Jersey and learned darkroom, still a development of still photographs. And that was absolutely fabulous. And I was there for, like, I don't know, maybe 6 months or so. This is what's really great about the whole thing, is that I am right outside of New York City. I am 22 years old. I got a couple of bucks in my pocket because I'm in the military. There is a bus that stops right in front of Fort Monmouth, very close to Red Bank, Count Basie, kid from Red Bank, New Jersey, a couple of stops away. Bus stops right in front of there, takes you all the way into the bus terminal, 43rd and whatever the heck it is, in the middle of New York City, man. I got on that bus. I went into New York City the first weekend I had, and I went every weekend into the city after that. I thought, this is heaven. I am home. As great as California was, you know, it's a whole different thing. New York City is the throbbing, vital, artistic core of the world. This is it, man. I saw Coltrane. I saw John Coltrane Quartet at Birdland. I saw Charlie Mingus rehearsing his band on a Monday night at the Five Spot with Eric Dolphy playing sax and a bunch of other cats. And I was like 3 feet away at the bar. He had spread out the charts on the tables in the club because it was Monday night and there wasn't anybody there. You know, there were a few people, there were a dozen people there. I'm sitting next to Charlie Mingus calling Eric Dolphy on the carpet. No, stop. Eric, right here. Look, check it right here, man. Just read it right here. Go ahead, play it one time yourself. Go ahead, play that, Eric. And Eric played it. You got it? Yeah, I got it. Oh, okay. All right, let's take it again. And they're off doing something, man. And then I finished up my schooling, darkroom studies, and they sent me off to Okinawa. And Okinawa was like, whoa, I am in the Orient. This is incredible. I was a darkroom man, but I didn't. I wasn't assigned to the darkroom in Okinawa, and this was fabulous, man. They shipped me off instead to Thailand. Now you know what grows in Thailand. you ever hear of Thai stick? So on the way to Thailand, we're going to go to some place called Koh Rat, Thailand. You know, the middle of nowhere, man, on the big plain, the central plain. Unfortunately, I wasn't down in the tropical lushness, loveliness, or in Bangkok or anything. But on the way to Thailand, one of these big, monster, jumbo moving people mover, equipment movers, we landed in Vietnam. So I was actually in Vietnam, in Saigon. At the Saigon airport, I wasn't allowed to leave the airport. I was in Vietnam for 3 hours. And I must say, I saw some of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. Those Vietnamese women with the áo dài, I think it's called, the long dress that they wear that's slit all the way up, and it's just, God, it's just flowing. And you can see that they were absolutely gorgeous. The women were so beautiful and so graceful and so delicate. And the fact that a whole war took place there and the slaughter was like, totally insane because it was just absolutely, it was a lovely country, just all around the airport, palm trees, and it was just, the smell in the air was just of flowers. So the fact that what went on there was a real tragedy. So I spent three hours in Vietnam, off to Thailand, man, where I got my hands on the Thai stick and the Thai weed. Holy cow, man, was that stuff strong. I remember sitting one Saturday afternoon, we had gone to into town. You could go into town and you could buy your mixed marijuana, cigarette, betel nut, maybe some pipe tobacco. We went into this one guy's place, and he's got a big chopping block and a bolo knife. It's about a, you know, 2.5 by 2.5 square of wood and a big bolo knife, and he's got clumps of Thai marijuana, pipe tobacco, Lucky Strike tobacco, and betel nut. And he would make a mixture and chop it up, you know, the same way you would be chopping up parsley. He would chop it up with his big bolo knife and, you know, give you like about a half a pound of it for, I don't know, $2, you know, half a pound, because it was like nothing. I mean, the stuff grew all over the place. There was no big deal to them. And we smoked that, went back to the base and smoked that stuff, man. And I, for the first time in my life, I realized the meaning of the word stoned. I sat in a chair in the hot Thai afternoon, the hot Thai sun, and every 5 minutes, I was unable to move. Every 5 minutes, I would have to put my tongue back into my mouth. I found that my tongue had slowly, like a snake, very imperceptibly come out between my teeth, between my lips, and down my chin. And there it was. And I'd be sitting there with my tongue all the way out of my mouth at the furthest point it would go. And at that point, I would go, gulp, and push my tongue back into my mouth. Sat there for 4 hours, man, stoned, in an absolute state of bliss. Now, isn't it interesting that I actually spent those 3 hours in Vietnam, in the Saigon airport, in the Saigon, the military base, and about 5 to 6 years later, the Doors become the number one band in Vietnam. Jimi Hendrix, of course, and the Doors, man. Guys have come up to me and said, you know, you guys are the soundtrack to the Vietnam War. Apocalypse Now, you know, the movie. And these are guys who are actually there. They said, man, you and Jimi Hendrix. Well, you know, what's interesting about all of this stuff, the reason I'm telling you all of these things is that this all goes to make up what the soul of the Doors is, you know, and I'm here talking to you as Ray Manzarek, the keyboard player of the Doors, and we want to know about the Doors. The Doors are these experiences. All of these things that happened to me and certainly happened to Jim, you know, because Jim was into the same sort of thing, more or less, you know. I was a little older than him, but he was a devotee of Tennessee Williams. Jim had done the set decoration for a performance of a Tennessee Williams play back in Florida at St. Petersburg College or wherever the heck he was down there in Florida. Jim had done the scenic backdrop for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Whether he acted in the play or not, I don't know. But what he did was he had a slide of a cancer cell. Now, Big Daddy is dying in the play, the Tennessee Williams Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. The movie is available, so you can watch it on video or laser disc. And a slide of a cancer cell, what Jim did is had that cancer cell enlarging, slowly enlarging through the entire course of the play until at the end of the play, we find out that Big Daddy is indeed dying of cancer, not as we thought. He hasn't kicked it at all. And this cancer cell has covered the entire back of the theater, the entire back wall. So, you know, Morrison was into the same thing I was into. He went to the film school at UCLA because he'd seen the same films I'd seen. He'd seen Black Orpheus, and he'd seen The Seventh Seal, Ingmar Bergman's movie, The Seventh Seal, in which death plays chess with the night. You know, that thing about death and the night playing chess. You've got to see this movie. It's a great movie. Jim saw the movie. It came time to decide what he was going to do with his life. He was going to go to UCLA to make films, because the whole point of making films was that it combined all the arts. It combined combined theater, it combined photography. For me, it combined music, and that was great. You could put music to movies, and you've got acting in the movie, so you've got all of this theater. You've got photography, you've got acting, you've got theater, you've got music, you've got everything. All of the arts combine into the cinema. So that's the thing that put me into the cinema department at UCLA. That's the same thing that put Morrison into the cinema department. And then all of the artistic background gets thrown into the doors. How do we bring this stuff into the doors? How do we bring the drama? How do we bring the melody? How do we bring the joy, the pathos, the sorrow, the terror? How do we bring the terror into rock and roll music? That's what the Doors were all about. Pre-deal John Densmore was terrific. He was a prince, man. He was, he was volatile, but then he's a drummer, and he's supposed to be volatile. You know, he had a short fuse and would certainly never get angry at anybody in the band. That's what was great about the Doors. Nobody got angry at the Doors. I mean, we never got angry at each other. You know, there were never fights within the band. No matter how crazy Jim got in his later years, we'd come into rehearsal, man, and it was Jim again. It was the four of us working on songs. There was always a tranquility and always a purpose to being in a rehearsal room. Being in a rehearsal room was the whole point of it was to make the best possible music you could make. See, here's the way it works with the Doors. There are four guys in the band. Each person is as essential as anybody else in the band. The drums are as important as the words. The words are as important as the guitar. The guitar is as important as the keyboard bass guy. Each thing contributed its 25%. People have said to me, well, Jim did everything. Well, you know, how could Jim possibly do everything? Jim wrote words and was the singer. Jim couldn't play an instrument. Jim didn't play. You know, you hear Doors music. That's not Jim's music. That's Ray Manzarek, John Densmore, and Robbie Krieger. That's Jim singing. And most of the time, those are Jim's words. You know, when you hear John Coltrane playing a saxophone, he didn't show McCoy Tyner how to play the piano. He didn't tell Elvin Jones how to play the drums, you know. Those are each guy. Jimmy Garrison plays those bass lines, man. That's John Coltrane is not showing Jimmy Garrison how to play bass, Elvin Jones how to play drums. It's the same thing with the Doors, you know. Jim didn't tell anybody how to play their instrument. Jim never suggested to me play an A minor there, you know. And Jim didn't say, you know, Ray, an E minor ninth would sound good in Riders on the Storm. Nothing was ever said. You know, we each had our area of expertise. That was one quarter of the pie. You remove any one of those quarters and you don't have anything. You know, the only reason people think Jim did everything is because Jim's so incredibly charismatic. You know, he's exactly what a lead singer is supposed to be. He's charismatic and he's handsome and dressed like a black mamba and was an absolutely fabulous guy and he would jump around on stage. He was a great leaper and a shaman on stage. So naturally, Jim got all the attention. And people would think that this is Jim Morrison's music. Well, in fact, it's the Doors music, and Jim would be the first one to tell you that. As a matter of fact, we were introduced at a huge concert somewhere. The DJ that was doing the announcing came out on stage, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Morrison and the Doors." And a guy came off the stage. People are screaming. The guy comes off the stage, and Jim Morrison grabs this DJ and says, "Hey, man, go introduce us the right way." And he said, I just did. He said, "No, you didn't." He said, what are you talking about?" I said, "Jim Morrison and the Doors." Jim said to him, "That's not the name of this band. Do you know what the name of the band is?" He said, "Well, it's the Doors." Jim said to him, "Well, go back up there and say, 'Ladies and gentlemen, the Doors,' you jerk." The guy went back up on stage and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, here they are, the Doors." Audience screams, and out we came. So for Jim and for John and for Ray and for Robbie, it was the Doors, man. It was a magic circle. You did not break that magic circle. You did not alter that magic circle by this superimposition of any ego. See, this is not an ego game with the Doors. The whole point of this is not to be involved in your own personal ego, but to get into the higher ego, the higher state of consciousness that art permeates. Art is a higher state of consciousness. That's what we were trying to do, to attain a non-egotistical artistic state in which we would give up being Jim Morrison, Ray Manzarek, John Densmore, and Robbie Krieger, and enter into that magic circle, into that circle of the Grail, you know, the Knights of the Round Table. And man, I got to tell you, it's a beautiful place to live. We can all do it. We can all do it on this planet. This is what the hippies are all about. This is what the 60s are all about. We can all do it on this planet if we want to. We can attain a magical state of grace and turn this planet into a virtual Garden of Eden if we want to, if we have the courage. If we have the courage and if we have the guts to leap up into that free place, to leap beyond all of those confines and dictates of the prevailing myth that we live by, and to create a new myth for ourselves, the myth of the 21st century. That's what we have to do.
So that was an hour of excerpts from Myth and Reality, the spoken word history from Ray Manzarek. Hope you enjoyed that. That was in honor of Ray leaving the building earlier. That announcement went out today, and station manager Ken suggested that I pull this out of the library since my guest for the hour had just canceled. We have Nardwar coming up next at 7, so stay tuned for that. You are listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and in Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org.
And you're listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Today on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, an interview with Damo Suzuki. Damo Suzuki from Khan and the Damo Suzuki Network on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on, yes, WFMU. And to begin the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, gonna play something by Khan featuring Damo Suzuki, Soup. So here's Khan with Soup on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on WFMU and in an interview with Damo Suzuki. Doo-doo-da-loo-doo, Damo!
above runs above. Class A day.